Gavin Newsom hasn't even officially announced he's running for president, but he already holds a 17 million person campaign list, a massive federal war chest, and he's out there running foreign policy trips.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It really is. So today is August 16th, 2026,
Yeah.
and welcome to the Deep Dive. We are so glad you could join us because we've got our hands on something pretty incredible.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the actual blueprints of a presidential campaign that officially does not exist. We're unpacking this freshly leaked, incredibly detailed, independent strategy document. It's titled The Gavin Newsom 2028 Presidential Campaign Strategy Architecture.
Quite a mouthful, but yeah.
Right. And our mission today is to reverse engineer exactly how a modern run for the White House is built from absolute scratch. We're, looking under the hood at the brutal mathematical hurdles, the geographic branding, and all those strategic chess pieces that get moved around the board long before a candidate ever steps up to a podium.
Right. And just a quick note before we really dig into this with you all. This material deals with highly polarized, highly charged political narratives. I mean, it maps out both left-wing and right-wing attack vectors, vulnerabilities, and progressive policy platforms.
Definitely.
So we really need to make it explicitly clear that we aren't here to take a political side or endorse any of the policies or opposition attacks we talk about today. Our job is just to analyze the raw campaign mechanics and the cold, hard data neutrally, looking at the strategy exactly as it's laid out in these blueprints.
Exactly. We are just looking at the architecture. And to do that, we have a pretty fascinating roadmap for you. We'll start by decoding this shadow campaign he's running and a rather alarming brand crisis buried deep in his current polling.
Yeah, that polling is something else.
It really is. Then we have to navigate the paradox of his California record, figure out how anyone survives the DNC's completely rewired primary gauntlet, and finally, look at the cold, unyielding math of stitching together 270 electoral votes.
It's a steep climb.
So let's jump right in. Where does a candidate actually stand at the starting line when they haven't formally declared? Because right now, Newsom is supposedly waiting until after the November 2026 midterms.
Well, he is waiting officially. But what's really fascinating here is that the infrastructure of a massive national campaign is already fully operational.
Yeah.
It's, what political insiders call a shadow campaign.
Right.
For instance, he has a federal PAC, the Campaign for Democracy.
Yeah.
And that PAC reported raising over $21.5 million for Democrats in the 2024 cycle alone.
Okay, wait, let's pause on that. Because having 21.5 million in a PAC, I mean, a state governor having a federal PAC isn't just about charity. That is a very specific mechanical tool,
Right, but
right?
holy.
He's raising money nationally to funnel to other politicians across the country, which basically buys their loyalty and, early endorsements for when he eventually needs them.
Precisely. It builds this sprawling network of political IOUs. And on top of that, he's taking high-profile international trips to places like Munich to build foreign policy credentials. He's visiting early primary states like South Carolina. He even launched a podcast, This is Gavin Newsom, where he actively brings on conservative figures to debate them.
Right, which is a deliberate effort to project national dominance, not just state-level management.
Exactly.
And he's backing it up with a massive digital footprint. This document highlights an email list of over 17 million people. That is a staggering national reach. But okay, let's unpack this. Having 17 million email addresses sounds great for fundraising, but isn't that just a list of people who click donate online? How does that actually translate to real voters in a primary?
That's the million-dollar question. A digital list proves you can raise money online when people are fired up about the news, sure. But it absolutely doesn't prove you have a cohesive, winning coalition.
Right.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the coalition data reveals a glaring structural vulnerability for him.
Oh, yeah. The Emerson poll.
Yeah, in a July 2026 Emerson poll testing the potential Democratic primary field, Newsom sits at 17% overall. He's trailing just behind Pete Buttigieg at 19%.
Okay, 17% doesn't sound terrible for an undeclared candidate.
It doesn't, but underneath that 17% average is this staggering gender divide. He has 25% support among women and only 8% among men.
Wait, really? Only 8%?
Just 8%.
Wow. That is a canyon, not a gap. And it makes you wonder what is driving men away so aggressively. It has to be the brand he's built over the last few years, right?
It's almost entirely brand-driven.
Because up to this point, his entire national identity has been the anti-Trump fighter. He fights for abortion rights, he fights for democracy, he gets into these rapid response social media wars with conservative governors.
Yeah, and that fighter identity is fantastic for mobilizing core base voters, particularly women who feel culturally under attack. But that 8% male support tells a very clear story.
That the combative culture war brand is completely missing working class and male voters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For a lot of those voters, abstract battles over saving democracy or, you know, Twitter fights, they just feel disconnected from their daily realities. Mm-hmm. They are primarily concerned with material economics, mm-hmm. wages, inflation, housing.
So if you are the campaign architect reading this report, you look at that 8% and realize you have to do a massive pivot.
A huge one.
You can't win a national primary, let alone a general election, just by being the guy who argues well on television. You have to transition into this, what the report calls an abundance and pro-growth executive.
Right, the builder brand.
Yeah. You have to start talking about AI innovation, bringing manufacturing supply chains back to the U.S., building physical infrastructure, raising material living standards. You basically have to rewire your appeal from a cultural warrior to a guy who physically builds things.
That is the core strategic pivot identified in these blueprints. To win those working class and male voters back, he has to prove he can actually grow an economy. And because he hasn't been a federal official, you know, the only way he can prove that is by running on his actual executive resume.
His time as the governor of California.
Exactly.
Which sets up the biggest paradox of his entire potential campaign. Because to win those skeptics over, he is forced to run on his California record. But California is simultaneously his greatest strategic asset and his heaviest political anchor. It's just the ultimate double-edged sword.
It really is. Let's lay out the asset case first, because on paper, it is undeniably massive.
Oh, yeah.
The 2025 data shows California's GDP is $4.3 trillion.
Trillion with a T.
With a T. That is 14% of the entire U.S. economy. If California were a sovereign nation, it would be the fourth largest economy on the planet.
That's huge.
He's signing first-of-their-kind executive actions on AI. He's managing a global hub for clean tech. And despite the dominant national narrative of lawlessness, violent crime in California actually dropped 10.2% in 2025.
So he can legitimately stand on a debate stage and claim he manages an economy and a population on the scale of a major world power?
He can. But then you flip the coin to the liability case.
Yeah.
And the numbers here are just as extreme, but in the opposite direction.
Right.
You have a median price for a mid-tier home sitting around $775,000.
Oh, man. That is more than twice the U.S. average.
Yeah. And even with a slight recent decline in numbers, there were still nearly 182,000 homeless Californians in 2025.
181,934, to be exact, according to the report.
Exactly. And people are voting with their feet. The state suffered a net domestic outmigration of nearly 230,000 people, meaning 230,000 more people packed up and left California for places like Texas or Florida than moved in.
Right. Add in structural state budget deficit warnings and, you know, the lingering cultural baggage of that COVID era French laundry dinner, which cemented this image of elite hypocrisy. Opponents have an incredibly potent, ready-made playbook just waiting to be weaponized.
They do. And the strategy has to account for the fact that he will face millions of dollars in attack ads focusing entirely on those specific liabilities.
It's like a real estate agent trying to sell you a Silicon Valley mega mansion. They are walking you through the property, hyping up the state-of-the-art smart tech, the solar panels, the incredible security system, while hoping you somehow ignore the fact that the roof is actively on fire, there are people camping in the driveway, and the property taxes alone will bankrupt you.
That's a brutal image, but yeah.
How on earth does a campaign logically defend that?
Well, you're spot on with the mega mansion analogy, but here is the strategic twist they're planning. The real estate agent isn't hiding the fire. The campaign's failure mode, as they call it, would be trying to deny the crisis or telling voters in other states they are wrong for thinking California is too expensive.
Because you cannot gaslight voters on cost of living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead, the strategy is to reframe California as a laboratory.
Wait, you mean using the fire as a selling point?
Yes. You acknowledge the failures directly. You say, yes, the cost of housing reached absolute crisis levels. But because I governed through the fire of that crisis, I learned exactly what was broken in our regulatory system.
Ah, I see.
The strategy document points heavily to his sweeping 2025 reforms to CEQA. That's the California Environmental Quality Act, a law historically weaponized to block new construction. Plus, his aggressive housing permitting overhauls.
Right.
The strategy is to own the affordability crisis and then preach build more housing as a hard-learned national lesson. He presents himself as a guy who figured out how to cut through the red tape because he had no other choice.
Okay, so he uses the dysfunction to prove his competence in solving it. He says, I broke the old progressive system to fix the housing problem. That is a really fascinating rhetorical move.
It's highly engineered.
But even if he perfectly threads the needle on defending that California record, it won't matter if he can't get his foot in the door. And that brings us to the newly designed primary calendar. Because the rules of the Democratic primary game have fundamentally changed for 2028, and it creates a massive geographical hurdle.
The map has been completely rewritten. For decades, the entire political world revolved around Iowa and New Hampshire going first.
Right, the corn dogs and the diners.
Exactly. The old system was defined by retail politics. Candidates would spend months walking into diners, attending state fairs, having long conversations with small groups of voters. It favored grassroots organizers who could shake enough hands.
But the new DNC sequence, approved for 2028, kills that tradition.
It does. The primary now starts with South Carolina on January 22nd. Then it moves to Nevada on February 1st, New Hampshire on February 8th, followed by New Mexico, Michigan, and Virginia.
Which means Iowa isn't even in the early window anymore. And South Carolina becomes the ultimate bottleneck. This fundamentally changes what is being tested.
How so?
Well, South Carolina isn't about diner handshakes. It tests whether a candidate has authentic, deep-rooted trust with Black voters. And if you can't win there, the math says your campaign is effectively over before it even reaches the West Coast.
That is the harsh reality of the new calendar. The demographics of the Democratic base have shifted, and the primary schedule now reflects that.
But here's where it gets really interesting to me. Does this strategy actually thank a California executive, a guy with a billionaire donor network and a very distinct Hollywood vibe, can just parachute into South Carolina in late January, flood the airwaves with a bunch of slick TV ads, and suddenly win over Black voters? Because that seems like a massive cultural disconnect.
Oh, it is a massive disconnect. And parachuting in with a bunch of TV money is precisely what the report identifies as the fatal flaw.
Good. At least they recognize it.
Yeah. The document stresses that Newsom lacks the organic Southern relationships of some other potential candidates. South Carolina voters rely heavily on community leaders, local officials, and church networks to vet candidates. You cannot buy that trust with television ads.
Right.
He needs local validators and deep community relationships. The calendar demands what the strategy calls a sequential widening of the coalition.
Meaning he has to unlock one demographic to get permission to talk to the next.
Yes. He has to win Black trust in South Carolina. Only if he does that does he earn the credibility and momentum to court Latino voters and service sector union workers in Nevada a week later.
And winning Nevada gives him the momentum to survive the retail politics test in New Hampshire.
Exactly. If he tries to skip a step or relies purely on his digital email list and his PAYC money, the calendar will crush him.
Okay, so let's play this out for the listener. Let's imagine he actually pulls that off. He survives the gauntlet. He builds the coalition sequentially, reframes the California paradox, and becomes the Democratic nominee.
Okay, he's the nominee.
Now, he faces the cold, unyielding arithmetic of the general election, the Electoral College map against the Republican machine. How do these blueprints map out a road to 270?
Well, the baseline is established using the certified 2024 map. Donald Trump won 312 electoral votes, and Kamala Harris won 226.
And to become president, you need 270.
Right. So assuming a 2028 Democratic nominee can hold on to that 226-vote base, which the strategy warns is absolutely not guaranteed. Yeah. By the way, they need to find exactly 44 more electoral votes.
44 votes.
And there are three distinct paths laid out to get those 44 points.
Let's walk through them, starting with Path A.
Path A is the Rust Belt Restoration. You win Pennsylvania for 19 votes, Michigan for 15, and Wisconsin for 10.
So 19 plus 15 plus 10, that equals exactly 44.
Yep. Add that to the 226 base, and you land precisely on 270. Mathematically, it is the easiest route because it requires flipping the fewest number of states.
Just three states.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But culturally, for a progressive California governor, it is brutal.
Right, because you are navigating heavy manufacturing, auto industry anxieties, and energy politics like fracking in Pennsylvania. These are regions that are highly skeptical of coastal elites telling them what to do with their industries.
Exactly.
So if the Midwest is culturally hostile to a West Coast progressive, that forces a pivot south and west. He'd have to look at the Sun Belt to make up the math.
And that is Path B, the Sun Belt Restoration. This path ignores the Midwest entirely. You need to win Arizona with its 11 votes, Nevada with 6, Georgia with 16, and North Carolina with 16. That gives you 49 extra votes, pushing you comfortably to 275.
Culturally, that actually makes more sense. States like Arizona and Nevada, with their tech industries, clean energy sectors, and, you know, diverse suburban populations with huge influxes of California expats, they might actually be much more receptive to a California pro-growth vibe than rural Pennsylvania would be.
They might be, yeah. But the organizational hurdle there is massive. Sweeping the Sun Belt requires a flawless run across four distinct, massive states. It's an exhausting, expensive heavy lift.
Right. Which leads me to deduce there has to be a hybrid option that hedges the bets.
You're looking at Path C hybrid diversification. It blends the two. You win Pennsylvania and Michigan from the Rust Belt, and you add Arizona from the Sun Belt.
Okay, so that gives you exactly 45 extra votes, landing you safely at 271.
Right. It diversifies the geographic risk. You aren't totally reliant on sweeping the Midwest, and you aren't forced to run the table across the entire Sun Belt.
So what does this all mean for you listening? It's like a massive political escape room. Path A has the fewest locks to pick just three states, but those locks are rusted shut from years of industrial decline, and Newsom might not have the right cultural tools to pry them open.
Nice analogy.
Thanks. Then Path B has way more locks, a grueling four-state sweep, but those locks might actually turn easily with his specific California tech key. And Path C is hedging your bets by trying a few doors in both hallways so you don't get trapped.
That is a perfect way to visualize it.
Yeah.
And this raises an important question that the document addresses. What is the master key that opens any of those locks, regardless of the path?
Right.
The analysis concludes that to make any of these roads viable, the campaign cannot rely on the old progressive messaging of the last decade. It has to synthesize his entire record into a very specific, disciplined mantra.
Which is?
Build more, lower costs, defend freedom, compete with the world.
Build more, lower costs. That brings us full circle right back to the beginning of our discussion, doesn't it? The 8% male support.
It's all connected. To win over those critical swing voters, whether it's an auto worker in Michigan or a suburban tech worker in Arizona, a Newsom campaign must elevate material living standards above cultural symbolism.
Absolutely.
Voters in those battlegrounds need to hear a tangible plan about housing supply, lowering energy costs, and bringing manufacturing supply chains back home. The fighter brand gets you viral clips on television, sure, but the builder brand is what actually moves the needle in the Electoral College.
And that tension is the true beating heart of this entire strategy architecture. On one side of the ledger, Newsom has this 17 million person war chest. He has absolute command of the modern media environment. He has the executive experience of managing a state richer than most countries. But on the other side of the ledger, he faces a brutal Electoral College math problem and a deeply polarized geographic brand that will be weaponized against him every single day. Seeing it broken down like this, stepping away from the confetti and the podiums, it really highlights the incredible, almost microscopic engineering required behind any modern presidential bid. It is a grueling mathematical and logistical marathon.
It really is a feat of engineering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can leave everyone with one final thought to ponder, building on this whole idea of the abundance and pro-growth repositioning we've been discussing.
Go for it.
What if the future of presidential politics is no longer about ideological purity or endless cultural wars at all? What if, in an era defined by massive inflation and crippling housing crises, voters just want an infrastructure and permitting president?
Wow.
We have to ask ourselves, are we entering a new era where elections are simply won by whoever can most convincingly promise to make it physically cheaper and faster to build a normal life?
That is a fascinating question to leave on. Maybe the person who wins the next era isn't the loudest fighter on the debate stage, but the best architect. Thank you for joining us today as we navigated the blueprints of this deep dive into the sources. Keep questioning the structure of things, and we'll see you next time.